Broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Business Radio, spotlighting the city's best businesses and the people who lead them.
Lee Cantor here with another episode of Atlanta Business Radio, and this is going to be a fun one. We got a studio full, and I'm going to kick it right off with Colonel Ted Studdard with Home Depot. Welcome, Ted.
Hey, Lee, good morning, and thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Well, I'm excited to hear about your story. You've led quite the life.
Yes, indeed.
So can you tell us a little bit about your career path and how you ended up at Home Depot?
Well, you know, it's kind of a funny story. You never expect things to happen the way they do. And gosh, I was on my way to the airport one Saturday morning, and my wife was taking me. I was in command of a large unit in Dallas, Texas. It was 8th Marine Corps District and had about 6,300 people scattered across a large portion of the country, and things were going great. I'd been called to Washington, D.C. to sit on a board, a selection board. I was going to be there for about a month. And I was leaving on a Saturday morning, which was somewhat unusual. Normally, I left on trips during the week. And by leaving on Saturday, Melissa was taking me to the airport, Melissa, my wife. Mm-hmm. En route to the airport, I didn't feel too good. And Melissa said, you know, you really ought to stop by the ER on your way. And literally, we went right past Dallas Baylor Medical Center en route to the airport.
So you figured you're going to be a guy, so it hurts, but it's not really pain.
Exactly.
Right?
You know exactly. So, of course, Melissa does just what any well-intended spouse would do. She punked me out. She said, you know, if you're not feeling well, you're going to make everybody else on the board sick. You really ought to stop.
And that was enough?
Well, that is, she was driving, so she pulled so into
she
the
drove.
ER.
There you go. So she took control.
Yeah, so she immediately took control. We go in, and I'm thinking, well, you know, this is Dallas-Fort Worth on a Saturday morning.
It's got to be slammed.
Oh, right? You just figure mm-hmm. that. Cowboys need to be sewn up right, from a fun Friday night. I mean, good gracious. Well, we go in there, and much to my chagrin, there's not a soul in there. I am the only person.
It's empty. Wow.
Absolutely empty. And I'm thinking, well, you know, there's a silver lining here. They'll right. take in me right out. Back, and I can make my airplane, and right. I am good to go, right? Well, I get back there. They triage me and take me back to the room, and I'm thinking, I really do have time to make the flight. Well, all of a sudden, the door burst open. A doctor and several nurses come in, and Melissa's a small lady. They just shove her aside and say, you're having a heart attack. Holy cow, I never imagined that. And I thought, you know, these guys have to have some mistake. I mean,
right, you feel good you don't feel like you're having a heart attack.
Yeah, here I am, a U.S. Marine. I'm not going to have a heart attack. But you know what? I was wrong, and they were right. So long story short, I'm not prepared to get out of the Marine Corps. And I started on this journey. I knew after the heart attack that things needed to change, that I wouldn't be allowed to continue on in the capacity that I had previously. And so I had to get a job. So
you felt that the military wouldn't allow you to continue with your medical condition, or this is personally like, hey, maybe I have too much stress, or this is too wearing on to me?
You know, that's funny. You know, the first thing that comes into mind is stress or something to mm-hmm. that effect. I just run my physical fitness test for the Marine Corps. I had a perfect score on that. Mm-hmm. I was in the easiest job I'd ever had in the Marine Corps.
Right.
And so stress really wasn't an
issue. So maybe you need stress.
Maybe it was a lack of stress, but just one of those crazy anomalies. And I was scheduled to go back to Afghanistan, exactly what I wanted to do and mm-hmm. where I wanted to be. The family was good with it. I mean, that's what I did. And I knew that given the heart attack, that would not happen. And I really didn't know what would happen as far as my Marine career. Mm-hmm. And it was a pretty easy decision. You know, if you're going to make a break, now's the time.
Right. This made sense.
Yeah. And I just didn't want to be some fat old colonel sitting behind a desk, quite frankly. I mm-hmm. wanted to get out and do things. And so that predicated the decision.
And then how about prior to when you were younger, what was kind of the catalyst to get into the military?
You know, I'd always wanted to be a Marine. My dad was a Marine. He served 4 years. My uncle was a Marine who fought in Vietnam. I'm sorry, Vietnam. He fought in World War II mm-hmm. In some iconic battles for the Marine Corps. My dad was between Korea and Vietnam. So it was really interesting growing up. Both of them served their 4 years and got out, but were very successful afterwards. And I saw how the Marine Corps impacted their lives along the way. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to be a Marine. I grew up in the same house. I grew up in the same bedroom. You know, no change growing up. And I thought, I just want to be a Marine, and then I'll come back and join the family business.
So there was insurance. a family business.
Yeah. My dad was an insurance agent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I had the opportunity to come back and join that. And I thought that's quite frankly what I would do.
So you thought you were going to do the same 4 years out job?
Exactly.
And then something happened in that?
Well, you know, I just fell in love with being a Marine. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, let me try another step and another step. And I had some phenomenal leaders along the way that really put their arm around me, some great mentors, and helped me see the opportunities. They helped me grow. And if it hadn't been for people doing that for me, helping me grow as a Marine and helping me grow as a leader, no telling where I would have gone.
Now, when you started in the Marines, you started as a where'd you start?
I started as a private.
So that's the bottom.
I started at the very bottom, and I can clean a toilet with the best of them. No, I started. I went the day after I graduated high school. 36 hours later, I was on my way to boot camp at Parris Island, South Carolina. Mm-hmm. I went through boot camp, and
so,
then.
And so you were excited? Like, what was the feelings, emotions of that?
You know, every emotion you can imagine, from extreme fear to extreme excitement, and
so
everything
some of
in between.
What did I get myself into?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Like second guessing this?
You know, the first day you're there and you have these crazy drill instructors yelling right. and screaming.
But you've seen movies, you've talked to your dad and uncle.
Right.
But you still weren't ready?
Oh, nothing prepares you for that. And you know, you're there. There's no opting out. Right. There's no, I made a mistake.
Right. The boats have been burned.
Yes. Yes, indeed. The boats have been burned. That's a great way to put it.
Mm-hmm. And then so you got in there and then you just started enjoying it and working your way up through the ranks?
I did. And literally, so I graduated from boot camp and I started off at the University of Georgia. I was in the reserves initially. And the first week I was at school at Georgia, I saw a Marine on base, our own campus. And I thought, wow, this is kind of unusual. There are no Marine bases anywhere near the University of Georgia. So I went over and introduced myself. And he said, you know, he told me his name. And he was a captain. He was the officer selection officer for the Marine Corps. And he said, would you like to be an officer? Well, this is a pretty
easy.
Yeah, this is a pretty easy decision. You know, I started off as a private. I've been promoted to private first class. I was at the bottom of the barrel. That didn't take long to make that decision.
Right.
And so when I was in college, I then started going to officer's candidate school. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did in the summers when I was in school. I was discharged from my enlistment. And then when I graduated from Georgia, then I was commissioned as a second lieutenant, then served 25 years on active duty thereafter.
And then from the military, then you had the medical incident, and then now it's time to kind of enter civilian life.
Yes.
And then that's another transition. Do you have the same emotions, like what did I get myself into, all those same emotions?
You know, they're very similar. And, you know, life is transition. I was thinking about this one day. I was teaching a class at Home Depot University. I taught leadership there. And I was rehearsing on a Sunday, and I realized that transition is something that happens every day. We transition physically. We transition mentally. We transition through relationships. We transition through jobs. We grow. But there are certain points in life when you have transformation. And transformation is an intense period of change and growth. And we all transform going into the service. But when you transformed into a soldier, sailor, airman, or Marine, it was a very controlled environment. You had drill instructors, you had your initial unit, but everybody was focused on helping you make that transformation into that next phase of your life. Mm-hmm. On the backside, when it's time to get out of your respective service, you're really doing that on your own. And
right, there's less kind of structure and support for that, right? You're kind of like, see ya, thanks.
There really is, and it's interesting. The longer you're in, I think the bigger that transformation process is. Mm-hmm. And we don't think that much about it, but I talk to guys all over the country literally every week about transformation and transition and what they are going through. And I think there's a lot of opportunity for us as Americans in corporate America to help in this process and to really leverage a lot of these veterans.
And that's something we see and hear a lot. A lot of veterans have come through here, and a lot of veterans in leadership positions have come through here. And they speak so highly of the training the leadership training and the ability to get the most out of a person and to get them to believe that they can do more.
Right.
And some of it, I think, is inherent in what they're signing up for. I mean, the why that they're involved with is pretty big. And a lot of companies, maybe their why isn't as big as that, or able to get the person to believe their why is that big. Where do you see that coming into play in leadership training?
You know, that's a great point. Leadership is learned. And you think about the leadership, a guy like me, 25 years in the Marine Corps, I had 4+ years of postgraduate education, and it was centered around leadership. Not to mention the mentorship that was ingrained in everything that we did and everything that we would do on a day-to-day basis. You don't realize how much you were taught, how much you were able to learn, how much you were expected to learn on your own.
Right.
And you just don't see that in corporate America. And I think we really miss the boat. And I have an opportunity to talk with corporate leaders. I served on the Military Appreciation Group Board of Directors for Home Depot. So I talked to, you know, Fortune 500 companies and guys in talent acquisition and training quite frequently. And I think we get so busy that we overlook some of the most basic things, and that's taking care of people through training and teaching and mentoring.
Right. It's one of those catch-22s, like you're afraid you're going to train them and they're going to leave, and then it's worse if you don't train them and they stay, right?
Well, that, but also I look at it as an investment in time. I get so busy, I just don't have the time to do this. But it's like putting money in your banking account. Mm-hmm. If you don't put a little bit and make it hurt along the way, you're never going to get the result at the
right.
end. And it's simply a return on investment in human capital.
And is that your role at Home Depot now?
You know, I think as a leader, that's always your role. Mm-hmm. I've had several different roles in Home Depot. I started off in a field leadership role working in the stores. And then I taught leadership at Home Depot University. Then I served in a talent acquisition role. I was responsible for all hiring and talent acquisition for our Western division for our merchandising organization. And now I'm in an operational role where I lead a team focused on our business-to-business operations.
So now talk about the book. How did that come into play?
You know, I was speaking at an event a couple of years ago, and I was talking to a group of professional athletes and guys like me, military professionals who were retiring. And I was talking about transition and transformation and making that step and how you do it. And afterwards, one of the guys said, you know, you really ought to write a book about this. And so I thought, I think I should. And so I embarked on this this book journey.
Mm-hmm. And then is it traditionally published or did you self-publish it?
No, it is traditionally published. Kohler Publishers are my publishing company.
So you had some help in with editors and things like that?
Oh, absolutely. And it was definitely needed.
And direction. So they gave you some directions. You gave them an outline. What was the process like?
You know, the process, I really started it on my own. Mm-hmm. And I worked with the lady who helped me, as we were talking before the segment started, really helped me capture my thoughts and to put the initial thoughts on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, I went back and, gosh, went through 8 or 9 different edits and wrote and rewrote and rewrote. And then after I had a good manuscript, I got in touch with a publisher. And they decided to partner and accept the book. And so.
So you were already 85% done at that point?
I thought I was 85% done. But, you know, it's really interesting. Every time I wrote or went back to rewrite, I found a better way to say or thought of a new mm-hmm. story or a new way to capture something. And it's written to be a very succinct read. I like to call it an airplane read. I fly a lot in my work and travel across the country, and you always want to pick up a book to read on the airplane.
Right.
And that's what it's designed to be, an airplane book. From, you know, flying across the country, you can read it and you'll be done on the other end.
Is it to help me as a leader learn more? Is it for corporate HR people who should read it?
Yes, to all the above. I really wrote it initially for corporate America, because I realized in my last role in the Marine Corps, I spoke a lot across the country. And then in my role in talent acquisition with Home Depot, again, I spoke across the country. And I realized that people, they appreciated what the service members did, but they had no idea. They had no idea that there was a difference between Forrest Gump and a crazy drill instructor to reality.
Right.
And so you have all these myths that are out there. And so I realized we've got this tremendous pool of talent, this human capital, but until our HR, corporate HR and our corporate leadership fully understands the background, they're not really going to be able to incorporate this extremely talented pool of individuals that we have.
Now, is this something that needs kind of a public-private partnership where there can be maybe, like you said, a transition or transformation period after, you know, they're done with their military career that kind of gets them ready for this next level?
You know, there is. I think there are a lot of organizations out there, vetted as one, American Corporate Right. Partners for another, that do a great job in helping veterans integrate back into the civilian segment. Just such things as helping with resumes, helping Sure. with interviews. But I think it's beyond those traditional things. How do you navigate corporate politics? How do you Right. find a job? How do you network? Those are
kind of these softer things that aren't as tangible.
Exactly. You know, everybody wants to help you build a resume.
Right.
But not everybody can help you navigate the corporal network.
And also to put their own kind of political capital on the line to sponsor someone, say, hey, you know what? This person's a good person. Take a shot with them instead of here's 10 resumes of people.
Exactly. And, you know, coming out of the military, you think, oh, I've got a network. That just has a bad connotation. Mm-hmm. And I think we miss the boat, guys like me, a lot of times, because we do think that, you know, I'm trying to kiss somebody's rear end, that right. kind of thing. And that's absolutely not what you're doing. People don't know who you are. And as a stack of resumes come in,
right.
if they don't know you, they're
and
not
And it's easier to say no than yes.
Absolutely. And so often the gatekeepers in corporate America don't understand what the veteran population right. has to bring. So they get shuffled off because they don't have industry experience.
So now you're enjoying your time at Home Depot. You found a good crowd to hang with?
You know, I think I have. And I really have enjoyed that. Plus the veteran community in corporate America is pretty incredible.
Mm-hmm. And then if somebody wanted to help and get a hold of your book, what are the coordinates?
Well, you know, some of the coordinates, let's start with Twitter and Instagram, and this is all new to me. So, at Ted yeah, Studdard.
I'm sure your Instagram's fascinating. We spent a lot of time there.
And then if you want to follow on Facebook, it's Colonel Ted Studdard.
Uh-huh.
And lastly, my website is tedstudder.com.
And then if somebody wanted to connect with you on LinkedIn, I'm sure you're there as well.
Yes, I am. Ted Studdard.
And then you're available to speak. You do speaking. And the book is available coming in the fall, right?
The book comes out on the 10th of October. And I do speak everything from strategic communications to leadership to transition and transformation.
Good stuff. Well, Colonel Ted Studdard, thank you for your service. And thank you for the work you're doing now. It's important work.
Thank you so much, Lee. Have a great day.
All right. Hang with us. Got a couple more guests. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we have Alicia Bridgewater, and she is with Atlanta Innovation Forum. Welcome.
Well, welcome. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
So how'd that go? How'd Ted do?
Awesome. I'm impressed. tough to follow.
Well, Alicia, tell us about Atlanta Innovation Forum. What's going on over there? I know they got a big name change.
That's right. So this Thursday, we're excited to celebrate that the Wireless Technology Forum is rebranding to Atlanta Innovation Forum. And that's really to reflect the broader focus now in emerging technologies.
So now it started out as wireless technology, so it was focused around that primarily?
Primarily, yes. You know, we started in 2004, which was 15 years ago, mm-hmm. and honestly, you know, wireless was a huge driver then
right.
and the focus of change, but, you know, now it's ubiquitous. So we want to expand our name to include all those other emerging technologies like IoT, fintech, you know, health tech, and even the creative areas like movies and music and gaming.
Oh, wow. So you really brought
yeah.
me. It's kind of like STEM went to STEAM.
Yeah, sort of like that, right.
So now, so the mission has changed slightly, right? So it's expanded.
Yes, it's just a focus on a broader level of innovation.
Right. And then how do you kind of let the world know that this occurred?
So we have a list of over like 4,000 members that have participated at one time or another. We have an active meeting group of about 100. And, of course, we have all the social media happening as well. And our website, I'm sorry, AtlantaInnovationForum.org.
So that everything's changed now.
Correct.
So this is the new world order, is the Atlanta Innovation Forum.
We're going to dominate. Yeah, that's the new world order.
And then, so now, this is in Atlanta. So are there other groups that kind of touch this a little bit? Or are you kind of carving your own path here?
So we're really focused on the Atlanta business community. That is our core focus at the moment. And again, you know, we're really about, you know, learning and educating and providing networking experiences and a fun place to meet, you know, new friends. It's very inclusive.
And then is it, is there a focus on students, or are they senior executives? Like who would be a good member?
Yeah, our target is, you know, anybody is welcome, but we really focus on folks who are in the business community right now. And then, you know, anybody who is a student or whatever, certainly welcome.
Mm-hmm. And then are there any special interest groups, or is it just the Innovation Forum?
Yes. So underneath Atlanta Innovation Forum, we have Women Driving Innovation, which is our women's SIG. Through that group, we have a much more diverse focus and female focus, obviously, really showcasing to date like over 60 women in technology.
Now, they're in technology in the role of an executive. Are they the coder technology person, or are they the marketing person, or anybody in any role?
It could be all of the above. I mean, anybody who has a very interesting story, you know, not every road is easy. So sometimes
sure.
The tougher roads are actually more interesting. And what we really realized through Women Driving Innovation is that there is a gap in our community where women want to hear from other women, and they want to hear genuine stories and also have a chance to participate, you know, earlier rather than later in an organization.
So now this is a situation where women, maybe they're in a technology role, and then they don't see themselves or other women around the table.
Exactly. You know, there are not a lot of women in leadership roles. I think that's an area that's really growing and an area that we showcase. We purposely showcase those women. But for those who are aspiring to get there, the road is not always clear and the mentors are not always obvious. So this is a great way to showcase those people and really make a personal connection.
Now, for you, was that your case? Were you involved in technology and then you were kind of the only woman in the room sometimes?
Definitely sometimes. I mean, my whole career has been in technology marketing, so I've really enjoyed it. It's been a wild ride. But I, you know, everyone needs a mentor and everyone
right.
needs inspiration and everyone needs to, you know, get to that next step if that's what they want to do. So
now is that like how are you going to handle the mentoring part? Is there going to be opportunities where you're matchmaking or you're, you know, kind of putting it out there? Look, we're looking for mentors. We're looking for mentees. You know,
we do have a mentor program as part of the Women's SIG that is up and coming. Right now, you would just be amazed because the room in those meetings just really evolves to, you know, here's how I did it. Here are the obstacles I overcame. And, you know, here's how I can help others too. So that's the Women's SIG. And I forgot to mention the mobile marketing innovation group as well. And they're a second SIG that we have under Atlanta Innovation Forum that's really about driving digital and mobile marketing efforts in Atlanta.
And then, but that's from the marketing standpoint, not just the
Correct.
Mobile standpoint, right?
It's mobile and digital under mm-hmm. Atlanta Marketing Innovation. That's the second SIG.
Right. So is that because there's so many kind of marketing automation firms, things like that? Is that going to touch that?
But, you know, marketing's obviously changing dramatically with all the, you know, change in technology. And one of the coolest things that that group has initiated is Alexa skill training.
Right.
So the whole new marketing channel of voice recognition is exploding. And, you know, we've taken the lead in that area in terms of come by and learn how to do an Alexa skill, learn what this new channel can do for you and your marketing.
And then, so that is a lot of education there?
Yeah, and it's a lot of hands-on. I mean, it's really fun, and it's not that hard. And, you know, we're, as marketers, you're always looking for a new way
right,
to communicate. So that's, they're just getting started, and that's been an initial focus of theirs, which has attracted a lot of attention.
So now, are the meetings going to change, or is it going to be the way that the wireless meetings were?
Yes. So Wireless Technology Forum had always a panel of great industry leaders mm-hmm. and audience participation through Q&A. But what we found out when we were in the process of rebranding is that, you know, lots of people want to walk away with an experience. They want to say, hey, I went to an event where I learned how to, you know, program an Alexa skill, or, you know, I was part of, you know, seeing a top innovation lab in Atlanta, or I was part of a hackathon. So I think we're going to include our panel structure, but also expand into more interactive formats.
And then will it always be in one place, or are you going to move around?
Yeah, this time what we're going to try to do is we have two phenomenal meeting sponsors where generally we host our meeting at the Atlanta Tech Village and also Atlanta Tech Park out in Peachtree Corners. Mm-hmm. But we are going to expand to try some new locations.
Do some field trips.
Yeah, and that'll bring in new people from different areas. Mm-hmm. Atlanta's so hard to, you know, traffic through. So I think the new locations will bring in a new group of people and some new interests as well.
And what's the most rewarding part of this for you?
Oh, wow. I personally have really loved seeing younger people and people in transition get so inspired by our speakers and start to believe that they can make that transition too, and they're not stuck any longer. They have a group to support them.
Now, how do you feel Atlanta's doing in terms of getting the word out around the country as we are kind of a player in this space?
Yes, I think it's great, actually. I think the Atlanta business community is so pro-communication, pro-business. You don't see that. I've been in a lot of other cities, and, you know, I think they do a great job. I'm really happy to be part of this community of business owners and professionals.
What about in terms of collaboration? Do you find that we're as good at collaborating as other markets or better?
I think so. I mean, I think the marketing that goes behind bringing major events to Atlanta, you know, like the Super Bowl and college championships and, you know, all the, you know, big corporate headquarters that have recently moved here is phenomenal. I mean, that's first class marketing. So
now you have an event coming up on the 15th. Can you talk a little bit about what's going to happen there?
Yes, actually. So everybody has got to come. It's going to be a really fun evening. It takes place at Atlanta Tech Park on August 15th from 6 to 8 p.m. And we're going to be featuring Michael Chong, who's recently published an exciting new book on Uber trends. So how trends and innovation are transforming our future. So it's a perfect tie with our new rebranding in terms of innovation. And he is a really enthusiastic speaker, and he's going to share like the top Uber trends we all need to embrace to be successful in the future.
And then so he's going to talk about the book, and I know that I'm going to be involved. I'm going to be facilitating the fireside chat after.
That's right.
So you think he'll be nervous?
I ask hard questions.
I ask hard questions.
I don't think so. I think he's going to be great. And it's going to be kind of cool because he's talking about, you know, an innovation tsunami is coming.
Right.
Due to time compression and the marriage of man and machine. So something that we all need to know about in order to continue to be successful in the future.
Now, is the location Tech Village or Tech Park?
It's Tech Village.
Yeah,
Atlanta
right.
Tech Village in Buckhead.
That's right.
The best place to go to hear more about it is AtlantaInnovationForum.org and look for the first event that you see there called How to Prepare for Innovation Tsunami.
And then members and non-members can attend this?
Absolutely. In fact, we're really looking to build outreach here. We've got a very devoted membership, but I think Michael will help us, you know, really attract all folks who need to kind of be on top of the technology curve.
Right. And then that event begins at what time?
6 p.m.
6 p.m. There's networking. He's going to speak, I think, around 7.
Correct.
And it'll wrap up a little after 8, I think.
That's right. And it's very affordable. All of our events are. I think that's one of the unique things about Atlanta Innovation Forum, as we really provide an amazing lineup of speakers for a very affordable price. So this event is $20 for non-members. It's free to members. You can be a member for only $99 and get, you know, 10 great events a year. So we're looking forward to seeing everybody there. It's going to be exciting.
And then who should be a member?
I think anybody in the professional community who feels it's important to stay connected with technology.
So you don't have to be a technologist at your company.
No. In fact, I think that's the perfect reason. And for 1 hour a month, you can, you know, throw out talking points. Like I just saw, you know, Michael Chong, you know, school us on Uber trends. So
right.
It's very helpful if you don't have time and if it's not maybe a passion of yours to learn about technology every day. And, you know, this is a great way to, you know, get up to speed on a wide range of AR, VR, you know, again, IoT, you know, all the things that are happening around Atlanta with the vehicle, virtual vehicles and things like that. So,
and it's one of those things where technology touches everybody. So, I mean, just to come to get kind of an overview of what's happening, whether you're involved or not, it's not hurting anything.
It's the most efficient way to go about it.
Right. And then so at every meeting there is a, so you think there'll be a speaker of that, of Michael's caliber?
That's what we always shoot for. Yeah.
Right.
We
have
phenomenal speakers here in Atlanta too. Mm-hmm. So, and we featured a lot of them as well.
Good stuff, Alicia. And the website one more time?
It's AtlantaInnovationForum.org.
And you can sign up there.
Correct.
All right.
August 15th.
All right.
See you there.
Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you, Lee.
Hang with us. Got one more guest. Next up on Atlanta Business Radio, we've got Adam Mosley with Uzima. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Lee.
Tell us about Uzima. How are you serving the world?
Uzima is a company that was formed, I think, like a lot of companies, out of a necessity, out of an answer to a question. And that question was, how do we bring clean water to the over 2 billion people who lack regular access to that?
So you had that question?
Our founder, Bill Coble. Bill lives in Kenya. He's been there about 10 years. And he was trying to serve a variety of communities and meet their greatest needs. Mm-hmm. And the one that seemed to touch on everything, as he was looking at healthcare, at education, at poverty, everything sort of circled back to clean water. Mm-hmm. And so he started trying to tackle this idea of bringing clean water to people in a really affordable way, at scale, without sort of some of the complications and limitations that you have if you're trying to create, large water infrastructure where you're having to deal with government entities and all sorts of things that tend to bog down that system. And so he went with a really simple solution, using a technology that's been around for decades, called hollow fiber membrane filtration. Hollow fiber membrane is the same technology that's used in kidney dialysis to filter blood, to clean blood. And we're using it in a water capacity, and we are able to exceed World Health Organization standards for the removal of bacteria, cysts, protozoa, all your sort of bacterial contaminants, which are some of the leading causes of illness and even death among children in the developing world.
So now when he identified the problem, did he go down different paths and say, you know what, about shipping water or different, like, did he play out different scenarios and then eventually landed on this filtration?
Absolutely. Absolutely. He first tried the solutions that were available. Obviously you don't want to reinvent the wheel. So he dug wells. They did different sorts of water purification systems. They tried existing filters that were on the market. And what they found was that the solutions that were out there didn't meet the needs of their community that they were working in. And really, there wasn't even a global focus at that point. It was just what's going to work for this community of mm-hmm. people. And so Bill comes from a manufacturing family. He has a manufacturing background. And so for him, it was just natural to say, well, let's make this better. You know, let's build a better mousetrap. And so he started working with some chemical engineers and some manufacturing engineers and all the people who have the smarts to take ideas and make them reality in that sort of physical product world. And it took several years to meet his checklist of demands. And once they did that, then we had a product that would suit his community that he was working with. And quickly word started spreading and he started hearing from other people saying, hey, I heard about this filter you're using. Where can I get one of these? And his answer at that time was, well, you can't really, we haven't set up a business. We're doing this, for our own
right here
projects.
Locally. Right.
And so it became obvious pretty quickly that there needed to be a company formed, spun off, just to deal with getting these filters out to other partners around the world. And that's how Uzima was born. So I always say it was sort of born by accident. But I joined the company back in 2017, to oversee the US side of the company as the rest of our team is really in Kenya.
So now the US side is, manufacturing and distributing, or is there water needs here?
There are some water needs here, sadly, in indigenous communities. there's a lot of water need actually on reservations. Disaster relief is another focus of ours. So when hurricane hits North Carolina, Florida, wherever, we tend to send units there because water systems go down. But our primary focus is international. So I work a lot with U.S. nonprofits, U.S. Corporations and foundations to help fund projects around the world.
Mm-hmm. And then the solution, is it something that I have a water bottle and I put this filter in and I pour the water and then now the water is clean? Like how does it work kind of
practically? So we have a number of products, but the one that's in the widest use around the world is a really simple household point of use system that essentially has two water containers. You can use 5 gallon buckets, which we have. We used Home Depot buckets down in Puerto Rico.
There you go.
You're welcome. Actually, Home Depot was very generous to us after Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico after 2017. But you can use just 5 gallon buckets or whatever containers are available. You attach our filter onto the bottom of it. And, it's a very simple gravity fed. Doesn't require any sort of electricity or any sort of special chemicals or anything like that.
So you poke a hole in the bucket.
Exactly.
And then this thing sits below the hole.
Exactly.
And then the water passes through the filter and then is clean.
Yes.
Is it that simple?
It's that simple.
Wow.
And all of this, you can see all this on our website at uzemafilters.org. And we even show you a little diagram that explains kind of how the filter works. Which is, it's a physical filter. So there's no, consumables. There's nothing to sort of dissolve. There's nothing to use up. And because of that, all you have to do to maintain the filter is to just back flush it with clean water, that you've filtered already. And when you do that, and if you do that regularly, then the filter will last for up to 10 years.
Wow. And so you don't have to keep replacing the filter if you clean it properly.
Exactly. If, you know, a lot of most American consumers might have a filter pitcher or something at home and they know you have to replace those cartridges.
Right. Like in my refrigerator, expensive. Every like 3 months, the light turns.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, when you're working in the developing world, you need long lasting solutions,
right,
and economical solutions. And so for us, a $30 filter that lasts for 10 years is a pretty economical solution.
As opposed to my $30 filter that I have to replace every 3 months.
Exactly. Exactly. Yes.
So now, what's your biggest challenge right now? What do you need more of?
You know, this is a problem that can be solved. And, the biggest sort of hurdle is getting the right money in the right places. There are technologies, ours and others, depending on the situation. You know, we don't believe that we're the sole solution. There are places that you need different solutions. But to bring clean water to the world is simply a matter of allocating the right dollars to the right places and the right technologies. And so, our biggest challenge is just constantly bringing in more funding, either to us, because we do implement projects, or to our partners around the world, who are doing the same. And so, you know, I always say you can't outgive this problem. If somebody wrote me a $1 million check today, we could have clean water for tens of thousands more people by the end of the year. You know, it's that simple. We can do 1,000 of these a day, distribute 1,000 of these a day with just our team in Kenya, let alone the rest of our partners. And so it's simply a matter of, getting the dollars moving in the right direction, identifying the communities, and then making sure that they have clean water.
So now, once you find a community that has a need, then you just give them the bucket and the filter, and then, like, how much education does it take for them to, you know, do it properly? Because, you know, once it's clogged up with all the bad stuff, and if they don't clean it, then you're back to where you started.
So, yeah, so education is a big key to what we're doing. The education on the use of the filter is actually very simple. Only takes a couple of minutes to show somebody how to backflush the filter, to remind them that they need to do that. The nice thing about the filter is that it sort of reminds you on its own. It will slow down. Water will stop flowing through it if you don't clean it. So then you sort of recognize, oh, I need to clean, you know, kind of like your car will stop running if you don't put fuel
gas
in it.
Right.
And so that part is easy. The more difficult part is when you're working with communities who have been drinking from this contaminated water source for generations. And you're trying to tell them, hey, now you need to put your water through this thing before you drink it. you have to give them an education on why that is. Even those who may have been to school and have learned about some of these things, you know, sometimes we know things in our head, but they don't really sink into our lifestyle. And I say that as a guy who eats junk food, even though I know it's bad for me, and I eat sugar, even though I know it's bad for me, and I don't exercise as much as I should. So it has to get from your brain into your regular daily activity. And for these communities, it's about teaching them that some of the things that that are really common, some of the stomach illnesses and those sorts of things that they've just learned to live with,
Can actually be eliminated. Connect the cause and effect of the water to the ailment.
Exactly. They just think, well, this is just life. This is
right.
Just,
this is how everybody goes.
Exactly. So you sort of have to educate on the basics of how these bacteria get into a person's system and what they do, and then you begin to bring clean water to people, and they start to see it. Then, like, oh yeah, I started drinking this water and using this water to wash my hands, and all of a sudden, I don't have
those stomach
illnesses right. that I thought were just normal.
Right. So now, is that what happens? You get into one area and then the people start using it and seeing that kind of benefit, and then they tell their friends and the village next to them all of a sudden wants one?
So the way that we run our programs, the ones that we're actually implementing hands-on, we find local leaders in a village or a community, people who are already respected, who are already known. And we go in and we gather them and talk to them about clean water, explain to them, hey, we'd love to come and do a project in your village. We want you to take these filters and over the next couple of months, use them in your home, give us feedback, let us know sort of, you know, there's so many sort of cultural things that
right,
happen.
But is there like let enough us know. Trust where they're like, yeah, sure, that sounds good, I'm on that.
They will typically, because it's sort of a branch model. We go through one or two really trusted leaders, and then they identify, you know, another handful of leaders, and we sort of branch out from there and rely on the trust that was built from those local connections. And then once you have you know, a filter in say every 10 or 20 homes, and they're using them and they're talking to their neighbors about them. Then when you come back around to say, okay, we're going to do 15,000 homes. Who's in? Almost everybody's in because they've seen it in their neighbor's
right.
house and this person that they trust.
But you have to do it in that manner. You have to kind of do it gradually, then suddenly.
Yeah. I mean, that's the best way that we found to do it. It's we get better response when we do it that way. Rather than simply sort of doing what a lot of groups do, where you just sort of fly in and
drop a million of them and go, hey, exactly. go for it.
Exactly. Yeah. And then you go back a year later and nobody's using them because they don't know.
Right. It's now like a drum. Yeah. They're not using it for the way exactly. you wanted them to use it.
Exactly. So we found that with education and with engaging local leaders, that we have a really great response, and people continue to use the filter year after year.
Now, what's a success story you can share, maybe, where you made a big impact in a location?
So back in 2016, we did a project for about 12,000 homes in a place in the Rift Valley of Kenya called Lynette. And Lynette is not far from the city of Nakuru, which is more of an urban area, but you don't have to go far outside of Nakuru before it gets very, very rural. And so in Lynette, there are a lot of what they call IDPs, internally displaced people. They're Kenyans who were driven out of another part of the country due to political violence. And so the government has helped resettle them in this area, but they resettled them basically on land,
right.
you know, just land. There's no infrastructure there.
Right. No one's going to kill you here. Go for it.
Exactly.
You know, make it work.
So they started out with, you know, tarps and tents and those sorts of things. And they've slowly built dwellings. And, but, you know, you have now these 12,000 homes that didn't have access to clean water. And so we went and did a big project there.
And when that's occurring, what does their water situation look like? They go to a river with a bucket and then bring it back, and that's their water for the day?
Yeah, typically. I mean, it varies around the world, but in a place like Kenya where there's plenty of rainfall, especially in central and southern Kenya, there's lots of rainfall. And so they just use surface water. But of course, that surface water is easily contaminated by animals and humans bugs, and everything. Right. So in Lynette, we did this project, 12,000 homes. And we, from the beginning, we do data surveys and data collection with our projects. And so we have a survey that we ask before we give someone the filter, and then we'll follow up 6 months later, a year later, to say, okay, what's the results, and be able to compare those and graph those. And in Lynette, what we found on our initial follow-ups is that we were seeing an 89.9% reduction in the instances of waterborne disease in those households. We were seeing about a $225 per year medical savings for these families, many of whom might only make a couple of dollars a day.
Right.
And we were seeing a massive reduction, almost 95% reduction in the number of school days missed. Right. For kids, in the number of work days missed.
Right. Like, you don't realize how many other things are connected
exactly.
to this.
Exactly. And so that was our data, and that was great. But, about a year ago, a little over a year ago, we got a call from the Minister of Health in that county, and they had been looking at their data. There was a cholera outbreak in the county, a pretty significant one. And they were looking at their data and seeing
which
clinics had, were sort of the hot spots. And they sort of saw this area that had no instances of cholera at all. And so they started asking around, like, what's different about this area versus others? And it was the area that we had distributed the filters. Right. And so they became really interested in what we're doing. And so now we have an MOU with that county, with the Minister of Health there, to put these filters, eventually, to put these filters in every home in the county.
Good stuff. So now you need more partners here in America. You need more opportunity and to make them aware in these other countries. If somebody wanted to learn more and wants to help, again, what's the website?
It's uzimafilters.org. That's U-Z-I-M-A filters.org.
Well, Adam, thank you so much for sharing your story today.
Thanks so much, Lee.
All right. Thanks to all our guests. This is Lee Cantor. We will see you all next time on Atlanta Business Radio.